Hello everyone, this is the Gingerbread Man and I'd like to welcome you to my home. I have a good friend of mine here today that I'd like to introduce. This is a Garrison. Please tell me a couple things about yourself.
Well, for the duration of this, and for honestly most times in my life, for the last few years, I go by Nameless now. I no longer go by Garrison. Garrison is dead. I buried him in my backyard along with a bunch of other... Anyway, so I shouldn't...
That's
fair,
though. I apologize.
Anyway, that's all bullshit. You have a nice home here. Good backyard. Lots of plotting space. But anywho...
plotting space.
No, anywho. So I make music. I'm a musician. I'm a rapper, a hip-hop artist, a producer. I do most of all of my own shit. Like, I make my own music. I mix and master everything. I record myself. I know all the ins and outs of, like, the technical side of playing with the computer and the programs and the microphones. I'm also a comedian. I also like to experiment with psychedelic drugs. I also like to read. I consider myself an intellectual. I don't have any like paper credentials. Like, I don't have a college degree,
you
but
don't
I consider
it.
Myself. I don't think so either. I think it's bullshit. I plan on going to school at some point for like quantum physics and psychology and other things that interest me.
Or you just need the textbooks.
Yeah, pretty much. So I just want to learn this stuff. But the other reason I'd want to go to school is because I'd want to, at some point, do paid research. I know if you study one subject long enough, eventually you can get government grants to just study that subject. You're just like a paid student.
That's the other way it goes with intellectual stuff. Because like I was going into social sciences, and unfortunately, social sciences that it's not a lot of actual applications. So 90% of it is either research or tenure. So you're either teaching it or you're doing research, you know, and I figure that's how it is with most of these sort of fields. Like, even if you're doing like chemistry, you know, like active chemistry would be researching new compounds, researching new drugs. Like that is the work.
Well, you'd be amazed at the amount of jobs in big pharma for a chemist. I mean, you probably wouldn't want to work there if you have any kind of ethics whatsoever. But if you have no ethics and you want to be a Nazi creating the next tech wanna die pill.
Did you ever watch that documentary with the lady who ended up stealing like thousands of dollars worth of drugs from her? She was a pharmacist. She was like one of those people in the labs doing that stuff where what would happen is the police would bring samples, and she was the lady who would test the samples to see if they were real or not. And over 10 years, she like stole like an entire bottle, because they have to have the version of the drug to compare it to. So they have like a fridge full of everything. And so she would take like, you know, a little bit of meth and like, oh, this looks like meth and this looks like meth. So she like ate all the meth and like was like dosing herself and like ended up making crack rock.
Oh my God. I never heard of that story. That sounds crazy.
It's on Netflix.
I have to watch it. What's it called?
I don't know. I apologize. Okay, well, I'm bad with names.
If you come across it again when you're scrolling through Netflix, remember it and write it down. Just text it to me.
It was a trip. There's too many of those good true crime documentaries now.
Oh, I know. My mom watches all that shit. There's a show that she's in love with called fucking Forensic Files. It's all about all that kind of... It's like the police side of the story, like how they caught the people using blood stains and DNA evidence and stuff. It's actually pretty interesting shit. They go into the science of it. Sorry, I gotta adjust my fucking teeth.
Do what you gotta do. Have you ever heard of the show called Mindhunters?
Uh-huh.
That was a really good show. I really enjoyed that one. Fucked me up, though, because, like, at the beginning, I really liked Holden. And then, like, over time, I did not like his character, especially by the end of it. Like, it was pretty crazy, but it's a good one. Like, I get into the true crime every once in a while. Like, I don't like people who, like, romanticize it, because, like, I'm not interested in the gruesome acts that they do. I'm more interested in trying to look at how and why they ended up where they are. You know, and as fucked up as it is, it's like, I got a little son. I don't want my son to go kill people. It's like, what if I can avoid putting him through the shit that turned Ted Bundy into Ted Bundy? That's like the motivation when I'm listening to true crime.
That's actually a really altruistic motive, though. Like, that's like, fucking awesome. Like, it's funny that you say you don't like the people that romanticize the acts. Meanwhile, I am addicted to horror movies and Halloween culture, and I do romanticize these things. Because it's soothing to me.
And a lot of people do get it. A lot of it's a big, huge thing, especially women. It's weird.
Oh, yeah. Like, it's like a fetish for fucking suburban white women.
Yeah. Like middle-aged women that are sending, like, letters to, like, Charlie Manson and shit. It's, like, real strange. You're like, why? They killed women. It's like, what the fuck? And they're like, oh, we like the Bad Boys. Like, really? Like, stealing a pack of gum or smoking some weed behind the church, that's a bad boy. Not somebody who fucking strangles women. Like,
no, see, that I completely understand. For me personally, I guess I don't go that far with it. I'll romanticize a horror movie. Like, if I watch some dumb college kids get sliced up by Jason or Freddy Krueger, I actually love it. I laugh at it. I've seen it 167 times, and it keeps getting funnier every time I see it. That's a line from Beetlejuice. He's talking about The Exorcist. But that's how I feel about House of a Thousand Corpses.
That was a good one.
Yeah, I keep watching it over and over, and it keeps getting funnier and funnier every time I watch it.
That was a good movie, though. I liked Rob Zombie.
I guess I draw the line with, like, fantasy and reality. Like, I'd never go up to a real killer, like, in prison, and be like, good work, sir. You know, like, I don't like that. I would avoid those people.
And in Mindhunters, the guy, I remember his name, is like, Alan Kapuchki is what his real name is, or Kapitu, don't quote me, I'm fucking terrible at specifics, but I know the character in the show, Holden, you know, like, that's how he got them to talk. He'd had to go in and start giving, like, the one dude, Edward Kemper, was obsessed with women's shoes, so he brought him shoes, you know.
Oh my god.
Like,
I didn't watch that much of the show. I didn't see all that.
It's super good, but he gets into these headspace, these criminals. Like, one of the dudes, this guy rapes this little girl, and so, like, he ends up, like, he gets the rock that they beat him up, they know he beat him up with, and he had this really good intuition. He's like, that's the guy. And so, like, he put all of the cheerleading clothes on top of this rock, and he's talking to this guy, getting him to talk about how younger girls or whatever, and he's like, he's getting real creepy, and like, he's getting on their level, and then all of a sudden, right at the crucial point, he moves the clothes and the killer sees the rock and just fucking breaks down, you know. And like, that's how, like, to get people to talk, you know, that's kind of what, like, that's what made me, like, hate his character, because he started getting real weird. You know, somebody who gets into that kind of work, who has to do that kind of stuff, who has to put themselves, like, whatever we expose ourselves to, we do pick up a little bit of it, you know, no matter how much we don't want to, you know, like, we still soak up a little bit of what we expose ourselves to. And so if your job is to get into the headspace of a criminal, you're going to get closer and closer to that. Like, it gets kind of creepy.
I totally agree with you on that. Like, my dad used to tell me that shit when I was a kid, because he didn't like me listening to, like, ICP and Twisted and, like, Juggalo music.
No, that's terrible. A lot of it's good. A lot of their
good. They have a really positive message for a lot of their songs, but some of them are pretty dark and gristly, where they're just talking about killing people for fun.
Or making corpses.
Yeah.
What do they call that?
Human centipede and, like, fucking eating dead bodies and necrophilia and all kinds of gross stuff. And so they're, I still listen to that stuff, mostly as a middle finger to my dad, because him and I don't get along, and like, I don't think it's bad to listen to it, just like it's not bad to watch Nightmare on Elm Street every once in a while. You watch it every night, you might, you know, get a little fucked up in the head. Well, yeah, it's okay to indulge a little bit, as long as you know where to draw the lines. Like, I still listen to Juggalo music, because I am a Juggalo, at heart. Not very open about that, but right now I'm just, and people know it's out there. Judge me for it if you want, but like, I don't listen to it all the time, because I know that if I were to just sit there and bump like Hell's Pit by ICP day and night, that was like one of their really dark albums, didn't have too many positive message, it was mostly just like gristly and gore and dark negative ideas. And so like, even they don't like that album very much. Like, the artist will say, like, oh, yeah, that's one of, like, the darkest things we've ever made. We regret some of it. It was kind of a, you know, a bad place for us. It even, like, when we were making the album, it almost, you know, fucked us up mentally.
Was it one of the ones from their beginning?
It was right in the middle of their career.
Really?
Very strange time. Yeah, it was right, because they dropped this album called The Wraith Shangri-La, and that was one of their most positive albums. That's the album where they revealed that they're Christian and that they follow God. And it was like nothing but positive songs. Then 2 years later, they released The Wraith Hell's Pit, which was like the B-side of it, you could say. And it was nothing but hell. like from a Christian point of view, is like their description and depiction of what hell would be like. And I guess like,
well, artistically, there's a point. Like,
of course, just like Dante's Inferno. Yeah, I agree. Fucking awesome. Yeah, so that's why I love that album. I absolutely love it, but I don't listen to it day and night. Just like I don't read Dante's Inferno like my Bible, because it gets to be too much.
Well, I have the LaVeyan book. I have LaVey's Satanic Bible. I have Aleister Crowley, you know, but I also have the Torah. You know, so like I'm intrigued by these segments of belief, you know, like I want to understand occultism. I want to understand and I want to be knowledgeable of it. Like I consider myself agnostic to the extreme of that statement and not God dependent. Like I consider my agnosticism to go over everything. Like we were talking about earlier with that experience. It could be either or. And I right in the middle is where I stand, because I can't really tell for sure. And the same with afterlives, the same with time, same with consciousness. Mm-hmm. Like all these things, I feel that in order for me to understand the concept of time or religion or whatever, you know, I want to understand the LaVeyan side. I want to understand the epitome of Mormon. I have the Book of Mormon too. You know, like in order to be like a true agnostic, I feel like it's my duty to understand every single angle of a situation to be able to truly be agnostic. Because if I don't understand an angle, then I'm missing out on a portion of possibility.
I understand that. I understand where you're coming from. I think it's really interesting to study these things from an intellectual point of view, like to just be aware of them.
Well, it's human.
Exactly. As long as you don't let your studies become you. Like, you don't want to study one subject so much. Like, what's that famous quote? Better to be a jack of all trades and a master of none than a master of one. Because it's like, you don't want to be a one-trick pony. And also a famous quote from Miyamoto Musashi from the Book of Five Rings, where he's another great book. If you want, he says, if you want to get great at one thing, become great at many things and apply all those different skills to the one thing that you really want to be the best at, because it'll allow you to think about it from all these different points of view and will really increase your skill set. This is also a perfect segue into what you wanted me to talk about a little bit with this Nameless concept.
Yeah, so dig into that. Man, so, tell me about yourself.
Nameless is not necessarily me. Nameless is everything. So my concept for Nameless draws a lot from physics. So by the way, Nameless is spelled NAMELESZ for any of you listeners out there who want to find me, because a lot of people spell it with two S's or two Z's, and it's LESZ. It's how you spell it. So anyway, Nameless is a concept that I came up with. I didn't like invent it. I more so like discovered it. That's how I feel about it. It's something.
And back in high school, because we've known each other since we were kids.
I've been thinking about it a long time.
He's had this name since like almost before I could remember.
And it's actually really interesting where it came from, because the name came before the concept. The name was actually my rap name back in high school. And then over the years, the term sort of evolved, and it was very, like, spooky how, the more I thought about it and meditated on this term, this concept, and was like, what is Nameless? What is this thing? Eventually, it, like, you start to get the feeling that, like, my lyrics are not coming from me as a solid physical human being. They're coming from somewhere else. It's still me on some level, but it's like more so like my higher consciousness.
Like you're a conduit.
Sort of, yeah. Almost like it's so, like the way I see it, I think the body, the physical body, is a conduit for the consciousness. Like it's a vehicle, and the consciousness is something undefined. And it's like being,
it's defining itself.
Yeah, it's defining itself through the body, through the form. And it's like your body, is a big antenna, and your mind is a signal that's streaming through your physical being. But Nameless is not just that consciousness. Nameless is everything. The nameless force of existence is what physics, I think, has described as like either string theory or the Higgs boson particle.
Or the Brahman or the Tao.
Or the Brahman or the Tao, if you wanted to get religious about it. Yeah, so that's
exactly what it is. I love it.
And so I've had this idea ever since I was like 12 years old that I think every religion and philosophy in the world is touching on something, but not quite perfectly describing it. And so that's kind of the definition of nameless. It's the thing that everyone's trying to touch on. We can't quite describe perfectly because we don't have a word for it.
Well, and the Tao that can be spoken is not the Tao.
Exactly. And as soon as
you try to describe it, you lose track of it.
They say the exact same thing in Kabbalah in Jewish philosophy.
I was going to bring it up because not to digress, but when you said the act of the antenna, it makes me think of the Keter from the Kabbalic Tree of Life, because at least Moshe Edel, which is one of those Kabbalic thinkers, he put out this idea he called withdrawal. So he said at the beginning of the universe, Ein Sof was supreme nothingness. There was nothing everywhere. And that this nothingness is being, because if nothing is in the state of being nothing, it is being. It's a being. And if being is in a being in itself, I got real confused. Never mind. But so Moshe said that you have this eternal space of nothing. And instead of a big bang, there was a withdrawal. So within nothing, the withdrawal, Ein Sof pulled from the inside and withdrew. And when it withdrew nothing on the inside, it emanated in the force of spirit. And through the way that it emanated that force is through Keter, which is the top shell of the tree of life. You know, the triangle, 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 triangle. You know, so that top one is Keter. And Keter is where Ein Sof emanates through. And then the idea of Ein Sof and all these Sephiroth, that is the essence of God. But with Kabbalah, there is no thinking God, which is something. And also in Kabbalah, every single essence of anything, every material object, every thought, every intention, every action, heat, cold, every single bit of existence in the universe is Ein Sof, because it's emanating into that space. So it's still the same thing. Mm. Like,
so I remember when I was studying Judaism a couple of years ago, I was talking to a rabbi who told me something really cool. It's a very, like, eerily similar quote to the quote from the Tao that you just said. Mm-hmm. So in the Kabbalah, it says that, like, so God in Hebrew has many names because he actually has no name. Many names, no name is the, like, the paradox of it.
Ein Sof is nothing.
Yeah, yeah. But so they also call it Hashem. Ein Sof is Hashem, and also Elohim, and many other names. Yahweh is another one. So,
but Yahweh without the vowels, which I thought was interesting. When you're reading the old Kabbalic text, Yahweh is WVWH.
That's how they write it. And it's very difficult to pronounce. Vowels. It's got a lot of phlegm in it. Yahweh. It's like, I'm a Klingon. So, no offense to any Jewish people. I love the Hebrew culture. We're just but wicked here. It's very much like Klingon. It sounds like it comes from space. It's just, Yahweh. But anyway, so in the Kabbalah, there is this quote that says, the Hashem you know does not exist.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you could find something very similar about Brahman and the Bhagavad.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Or probably more like the Vedas, because the Bhagavad Gita focuses more on Krishna. But same fucking being. That's what's so interesting about Hinduism. It's all the same entity. It goes by many names and different forms.
No, I couldn't agree more. And I think that a lot of these godheads, I think most of these religions, though, that were hitting on the same thing, none of them had speaking gods, you know? And even when Krishna and Ram and all those come out of Brahman, you know, even when they, what do they call it? Missing the word. Because Brahman pulls himself into Ram as the godhead, right? And then pulls himself into Krishna. And so that's how he displays himself. And then, of course, everybody else, all the humans, are emanations of Brahman as well. Mm-hmm. You know? So it's like, but the Brahman itself isn't a thinking being, you know? Like, but I think that out of this fertile ground for this non-dualistic gods, that a lot of these places seem to have all come from a very similar, I feel like it was either one school of thought that split, or it was a school of teachers that talked to many people and inspired a lot of similar ideas.
This is
what I feel like about it.
I met a yogi in Manitou Springs a couple months back, and he explained it to me, because I've been studying Hinduism for a few years, but it's very, very complicated. So the way the yogi explained it to me, it made a little bit sense for me. So Brahman, like you said, he's not a thinking being. Brahman is thought itself. Yeah, it's a pure thought stream.
Well, even the material objects, even non-life, you know, like, that is still part of it.
Like, and what's fascinating about that, too, is that, like, quantum physics is getting to the point where there are many scientists who believe that particles themselves, at their smallest level, are energy, like a wavelength that has condensed itself into a physical form, and they think that that energy, that wavelength, is a type of consciousness. Like, not like yours and mine, but some kind of a measurable electromagnetic wavelength that's not just like a dead jolt of electricity. It's something more than that. Like it contains data. Mm-hmm. And like the fact that this wavelength contains data that is somehow conscious. And I don't understand it. I haven't studied quantum physics that deeply yet, but I was going to say, the way this yogi explained it is like, there is this being, or this state of beingness, it's both things. It is a being and a state of being. It's called Bhagavan. Mm-hmm. Bhagavan is the same thing that's described in the Kabbalah that you said, the Hashem, mm-hmm. the original being that, what was the word you used?
Withdrew.
Withdrew, yes. So the beingness was once whole, and then it withdrew within itself. And Hinduism describes something very similar, where like Bhagavan is a state of wholeness, and within Bhagavan there is the Brahman, which is the withdrawal, and the thought stream, which causes existence. But all of that existence is just a dream within Bhagavan.
That creature.
Yes. That so entity. That state, that creature, whatever it is, and so this entity, this creature, we can call it that, it is everything. And in Hinduism, the whole goal of that religion is to like clear yourself, almost like in Scientology, becoming clear, but not the same thing. It's like it's becoming pure to get back to Bhagavan.
It's what the ascetics were trying to go to.
Yes.
The ascetics believed that if you kill desire, if you take away all those things that seem like intrusions, then that you'll become closer to the Godhead.
Yeah, and just like in Buddhism, if you get rid of everything, you go to Nirvana.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Only the Buddha, his big thing that I thought was enticing, because I just finished the Dhammapada, he refused to go. That's kind of like the essence of the Mahayana, or Mahayana, I think, was that he had the ability to get across the river, as they said, you know, but he felt that it was his duty to go and show as many people as possible during his life the ability to go across the river. Whereas the traditional Hindi school of thought before that, especially through the ascetics and all the sorcery, you know, is like, if you have the ability to go, you go. You know, he considered it more selfish, whereas having the ability to leave and then staying on purpose to be able to show more people how was like the essence of his philosophy that I gathered. And then, like, I just talked to this dude on Facebook who's a Hinayana Buddhist, the whatever comes from the Theravada or whatever. And they kind of backslid a little bit into more of that asceticism. And I felt it when I was talking to him as well, was he has strict, you know, teachers that he goes to, and then strict practice, you know. Whereas the Buddha, I didn't really feel like it was that strict. And like, even listening to people coming and talking to him was like, you know, this is very simple. You know, you just, you find peace. You love yourself. You drop attachment. You know, that's it. And the guy would come up and be like, well, what about the afterlife? It doesn't matter. You know,
it really does not matter.
Yeah. We don't have to talk about it right now. You could stay completely agnostic about it. And as long as you're focusing on compassion, how do I drop my attachments right now? What do I do to better myself and people around? And I found that so beautiful reading it from him. I really enjoyed it, you know, like...
Well, the Dhammapada is one of my favorite books. I've read it a couple of times. So good. There's this really interesting quote in there that you just touched on. They're talking about how... Oh, by the way, for those of y'all listening, I don't normally have a southern accent this deep. I'm just getting my teeth straightened right now. I'm using those, like, invisible plastic braces. And they're causing me to talk like I'm from Louisiana.
And Garrison's always done accents.
I have usually done accents, yeah, but this one I'm not doing to be funny or on purpose. It's literally, if I don't do this accent, it'll hurt my mouth. Yeah, I can't speak. So, anyway, in the Dhammapada, there's this really interesting quote right near the beginning where they're talking about how I'm paraphrasing, but essentially they said, if you reach nirvana, you will not see the wheel of death. And I always interpreted that to mean, there is no afterlife if you reach this state of Bhagavan or Nirvana or heaven.
To go back.
Exactly. Well, that would be reincarnation. But I think in Buddhism, they see the wheel of death. Like, the wheel of life is reincarnation. And then in Buddhism, there's the wheel of death. Mm-hmm. Where it's like...
Well, you have to come back. At least that's what I got out of the Dhamma, was that if you don't reach across, then you have to come back and try again.
Yes, that's part of it.
But the Buddha taught that it was almost impossible for... He even said it was impossible for a person to do it in one life.
Well, see, that's part of it, and you're not wrong. But there's another thing they believe in Buddhism that goes a little bit further. They believe that if you reach nirvana in one specific lifetime, then you don't even have to die. Mm-hmm. That your consciousness will just sort of like float off out of the body very peacefully, but your body will still like be alive, mm-hmm. like a zombie or like a shell. And there's even tales, there are stories of bodies that have been found. They found about 50 of them all around the world, supposedly. They're like Buddhist monks who sealed themselves up inside of crates. Mm-hmm. And they just left. Or they died somehow. But when they fucking analyzed the tissues...
It hasn't rotted?
No rot at all. The cells are in fact still alive, but there's no consciousness. And they're not even in a coma. Like, they test the brain activity and nothing. Like, they are fully, like, they should be dead, but the body is still, like, the organs are still functioning, heart's still beating very slowly, but cells are still alive. Now, you can call bullshit on that, and I wouldn't even argue with you, because it could be bullshit. Well, but
a lot of them even say when you ascend that they just disappear.
Mm-hmm. There's like, a lot of different religions, too.
A lot of the gurus supposedly...
That's right out of the Bible.
They just disappear, like their mm-hmm. bodies are gone when they ascend. And it's like you'll be talking to them, and then they'll just be gone mm-hmm. completely.
So, like, I hate to reference the Bible, because I'm not Christian, and I
read it.
I'm a hypocrite. I talk shit on the Bible and Christianity, but I reference it all the time. So
I like Jesus.
Yeah, I love Jesus too. He's my favorite character in the Bible.
He's good. He was a cynic. He was just like we were talking about earlier. Jesus, his philosophy was very close to Diogenes. He was a cynic philosopher. If you look at it, he was a cynic.
Jesus was an interesting guy. They say that he made good sandwiches. You know, everybody knows that the devil is the main character of the Bible, and of course God comes in second. But I don't know. Not a lot of people talk about Jesus. I don't think he gets enough respect, especially here in America. He's my favorite character in the Bible. I think we should build more buildings to honor this Jesus dude. And then, like, you know that wooden thing that goes like that? We should, like, build a bunch of those everywhere. And we should, like build them all over the place. Because there's not enough crosses. There's not enough churches. So, I'm being sarcastic right now.
So there's three...
I'm totally joking.
There's three Gospels in the entire Bible mm-hmm. that are actually the words of Jesus. You can read the words of Jesus in less than 30 minutes. Everything else... in the New Testament, at least, is apostolated. It's by disciples, or it's mm-hmm. pre and before.
Oh, yeah. My grandma had this really cool Bible. It was one of those ones that had all the quotes of Jesus highlighted in red. Mm-hmm. So you could just sit there and flip through it and just read the quotes from Christ.
It's tiny.
Very, very good advice. All the other shit is very convoluted. And that's why I love to quote Christ in the Bible. The reason I brought Jesus up is because a lot of people like to think that like, the way the church tells the story, Jesus is like this demigod, son of the one God and superpowered magician, and he's like Merlin, but with, like, sandwich powers, and he can make everybody a nice lunch and raise the dead, and he died for your sins, and you have to be guilty about that. You have to feel bad and give us your money. You gotta give us part of your paycheck, because Jesus died for your sins. That's the way the church tells it. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people like to look at Jesus as possibly a yogi, in his own culture.
He was a cynic.
He preached against the banks and the government. Sorry, I know you've been waiting to talk. You go, please.
So, the thing I think is interesting about that, though, is it's the exact same thing with the Dhammapada. Because the Dhammapada is notorious for supposedly being the words of the Buddha. There's over 16,000 pages worth of Buddhist canon that is usually respected from Hinayana through Theravada. But the Dhammapada is a collection of what? It's like, I think it's like 600 verses.
423.
You can read it in less than 30 minutes. And it's the exact same situation with the Bible and Jesus. And I have a lot of issues with monk classes of Buddhism past the Dhamma.
Me
like,
too.
Like
Me
Hinayana. Too. Like, when, like I'm not a big like fan because like a backslide into ascetic Hinduism is a distance away from that. And back on Jesus. So we were talking about earlier, it was this is cynicism. And so the father of cynicism is this guy named Diogenes. And so he was the student of Antisthenes. Antisthenes was the student of Socrates. So mm-hmm. if you've ever read Plato's The Republic, Antisthenes is a character in The Republic. So Diogenes is Antisthenes' teacher. And if you remember The Republic at all, Antisthenes has a very cynical outlook, you know? And so what Diogenes does is they call him the dog. And that's why they call it cynicism, because it's a Greek word. I think it's like sceneros or scenekar, something like that. But that means dog. But it's a derogatory term for a dog. It means a low dog. So that's where the term cynicism comes from, is because they called him Diogenes the dog. He didn't wear any clothing. All he had was a blanket that he'd use for his protection, that he would use to be able to lay down at night. And he was basically a vagrant. So he'd sleep where he could. He'd sleep inside the bathhouses during the winter because they were warmer. And he would beg for food, basically. But he was very pointed about how he begged. He wouldn't beg from just anybody. He would beg from the rich. He would beg from people that he knew had resources to give. And he would teach on how to beg appropriately. And he thought that begging wasn't asking for anything, because he thought that everybody in humanity was connected. And so that by asking for food, he wasn't asking for anything but what was already his, was his philosophy. He's like, you're giving me what's already mine because this is ours.
But he was also a cynic.
That's the basis of cynicism. So the word cynic has a very... it's lost its way, and there's two versions of cynic. There's capital C cynic, and then there's a lowercase c cynic. And so Diogenes' philosophy was, you don't need anything. That's why he didn't wear clothes. He didn't think clothes were necessary, because we're animals. All you need is a blanket. If you have something to lay on and something to cover yourself, you're okay. Diogenes would publicly masturbate in public. He thought, he was quoted as saying, if it was this easy to get rid of a stomach ache, everybody would be doing it. So he thought that, spurned money. He thought that money and currency and every abstraction that is based upon, that is above nature. So since we abstractify and we create money, money's not necessary. Food, he would only eat plain food. He wouldn't eat anything extra. So the cynical lifestyle is only what you need, you know? And the other thing about him is he would do exactly what Socrates did. So he spent all of his time, he didn't have a job, he was a vagrant basically, but he would spend all of his time talking to people. And he was notorious, because what he would do is he would go find people who were arguing. And even when people were arguing, they'd find him. They'd be like, hey, so-and-so's fighting, can you go break it up? And the cynics were notorious for going in and helping people solve differences and talking to people about their problems, because since they didn't go for anything extra, they could easily use their philosophy to say, hey, what do you really need out of this situation? You know, this is your friend. You know, is this really worthwhile? Because everything else is extra. It's all abstractions that are built from our reason, but aren't really natural. It's not our real base nature. We're just making shit up, you know? Like, and that's the cynic philosophy. Like, I loved it. Like, reading these words, he hit me heavily. And then when you look at Jesus's words, what was Jesus really preaching? You don't need anything but love. Give to your neighbor. Give as much as you can, you know? Like,
so I was talking to a friend of mine recently. Okay, you know what? I cannot comment on Jesus right now, because I got to comment on something else you just said. The motherfucker was masturbating in public because he could cure a stomach ache. All right, let me tell you something. I've had many stomach aches over the years. I got a lot of health problems in my intestinal system. If masturbating could cure a stomach ache, I would know. I've tried.
No, he was saying that if it was this easy to get rid of a stomach ache, he said if you could just yank something real quick and then that could get rid of your hunger, then everybody would be doing it.
I know, but I'm saying that, like, the way he says it, it makes it sound like he was jacking off on the street corner to get rid of the tummy aches. No. And I'm just like, God damn, this dude was fucked in the head. Did he get kicked by a mule by a kid?
No, he was like, I'm horny and I'm trying to get rid of the feeling.
Like, it sounds like he got kicked by a mule when he was a kid. He was like, he's probably trying to jerk off the donkey. And like, clunk. It could have been. Okay, but anyway, so back to Jesus. Now, I was talking to a friend of mine recently about how, there's a lot of different theories about Jesus, and I don't know which one to believe, because there's one theory that says Jesus never existed, and he was actually fabricated by the Roman elite to control the people in a, like, religious changeover, because they realized that the Roman faith was, like, losing popularity, and they're like, okay, we need a new gimmick to trick people.
The Romans hated Christianity.
But I don't know if it's true or not. It's just an interesting idea. So there's another interesting idea that my friend of mine told me about called Jesus was a Gnostic. Do you know what Gnosticism is?
Not as much. I've heard the term, but I haven't dug too much.
So there's a lot of different interpretations of Gnosticism, but the layman version of, like, all the different Gnosticism, like, the they all sort of...
It's a blanket term.
It's a blanket term, like paganism. It's just like how Buddhism, there's different versions of Buddhism. They got their own different little specificities. God damn it, I got a slur. I can't, like, enunciate properly with these damn braces. But, so... there's different subsets of Gnosticism, but they all have the same goal, which is to combat this evil demon, god, demigod entity known as Jehovah, which is the god of most of all the major religions of the world. It's actually a demon that has tricked people into worshiping it to give this entity free energy. Like, it feeds off of their worship by, like, gets energy from it, belief, something like that. And so the idea that Jesus was a Gnostic is this idea that Jesus was a part of this group of people who were intent on
combating this evil force.
What?
Promoting this evil
force? No, fighting it. They were intent on combating every religion worldwide. That's what the Gnostics' goal is, because they believe that the god of every religion is actually an outside entity that is lying to people to get something from them, and it's using us. It's abusing us.
That reminds me kind of Rick and Morty.
It's a little bit like that, but they also believe that there is another god internally, similar to the Buddhist idea of, like, your consciousness is the true thing to go after, or, like, in Hinduism, they say that the true god is within your heart, because, like, Krishna is Vishnu, which is Brahmins, like, God is in you, not out there. So, in Gnosticism, they say the same thing. It's like, the real God is not, it's not saying that you're God, it's saying that the energy of the true cosmos, or the true pure self, it's like the same thing I call nameless, it's within you. And then there is something evil out there that's trying to trick you and say, like, no, 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 don't worry about that, worship me, don't go inside yourself. Something
out there.
Yeah, yeah, it's like a like something that we want to call daddy or whatever the fuck, like the creator. It's like giving us false answers to questions that we never asked.
It's the anthropomorphized God that actually has feelings.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
It's the institutionalized God.
Yeah, the God that gets jealous when you worship other gods. The gods that, you know,
Whereas if you had a non-dualistic God like the Ein Sof, you know, that emanation, even it's Buddha too.
Yeah, exactly.
It's
yeah.
Every single bit of every belief, you know, like you said.
Just like with Nameless, it's everything. It manifests as everything. And so the false god in Gnosticism doesn't want you to know that. It doesn't want you to believe in that or you to have access to any kind of information like that. And if you look at Christianity as a religion, as like a political entity, the church specifically... Mm-hmm.
It is a political entity.
Yeah, definitely. Exactly what it definitely. Is. If you look at what the Christian and the Catholic Church specifically, the Vatican, if you look at what they have done in the 2,000 years that they've existed, kind of makes me believe that Gnosticism might be right. Like, there might actually be this evil thing that's, like,
at least organized. Trying to...
Yeah, yeah.
I just always feel like as an individual thing, like...
It might not even be a supernatural thing. It could just be people.
It could just be people. And, like, yeah. I always say a lot of the time that I'm very fond of the individual. But if you had 1,000 very smart people, or if you had a group of smart people, the more smart people you had in one room, the lower the intelligence would go. Doesn't matter if they're all the smartest people in the world. Mm-hmm. And, like, I'm always very fond of the individual, and I think a lot of the mistakes that happen is when we start to have that group think and start to try to institutionalize things. You know, like, I trusted the Buddha. I like the Dhammapada. But I have a lot of shadiness when it comes to, like, a lot of what the monks wrote, you know? And, like, I don't trust the Bible. I didn't trust Moses, you know, but I'm very fond of the Jesus, you know? Like, it's like I keep finding myself in these segments where I don't like the institutions built around a lot of things. But when you look at the individual and you look at the people, there's nothing much wrong with it. You
know? Oh, yeah. Like, just like psychedelics. I know this is a strange segue, but I see the connection here. Do you want to hit that? It's weed. So, there's a very fascinating parallel here. You look at psychedelics. You look at the father of LSD, Albert Hoffman. Great guy, wonderful ideas, wrote a few great books, used acid for good reasons. The hippie culture that was created around LSD, bullshit. Mm-hmm. Full of woo-hoo nonsense. Charlie Manson. Yes, exactly. Although Charles Manson was actually created by the CIA, according to new information that's recently been released. Manson was actually a operative working for the CIA.
He spent a lot of time in jail being an operative.
Yes. He got fucked. Mm-hmm. I guess you've heard about that. You probably... It was on Rogan's podcast. You might have heard it on there.
I do a couple true crime podcasts.
Okay. Stuff. It was probably on there, too. It was a big story, like, 6 months ago when it broke. Like, the author of this book, he's the guy that, like, broke the story. Mm-hmm. The whistleblower or whatever. But, yeah. You, I'm sure you know it because you watched the documentary.
Those people did take it, though. Those people did get, like, who is it? Laura Kasfabian or whatever. I can't remember their names.
Sharon Tate. Yeah.
Well, that was the girl who got killed.
Oh,
I'm
no.
I'm talking about her. The his killers. Family. Yes.
Oh, I don't know their names. So
they tell horrendous stories about, they were dosed quite often.
Yeah, so for those of you listening to the podcast who don't know the story, please don't take what I said the wrong way. Manson was an operative for the CIA before the murders. Yeah. And then sometime after he got, like, discharged, he went, like, left field, AWOL, yeah, and started doing his own thing.
He had his family.
But a lot of people suspect that he did so because of what happened to him when he was working for the government. Because he wasn't, like, a full-blown CIA operative. He was more like an informant, yes, rat.
He was just ratting out.
Yeah, yeah.
That was happening. And that makes sense. I can get behind that. That makes sense. Because he didn't really do anything except talk.
Uh-huh.
He talked people into doing shitty things.
And he also had weird connections. Like, he had weird, like mob, mafia-type mm-hmm. connections. That's where
he got his acid.
Uh-huh. I think he got that from the government.
Well, that's why he went and tried to rob Sharon Tate in the first place. At least that's what he said. At least that's what I heard, was that the guy who they were supposed to get in their drugs from, I guess he shorted them, or so he didn't have enough money. So that's why they were even trying to go get something. And, like, it was, like, this weird story, but then everybody was fucked up. And I don't know. It's so convoluted. But back, so the hippie drug movement. Let's get on that.
Yeah. The father of the hippie drug movements, not just Albert Hoffman, but all of these psychedelic proponents,
like,
and their
Stamets or McKenna's or
even Hunter S. Thompson, kind of like a little erratic, but
Huxley
and Albert. Not Albert. What, Leary? Leary. I don't remember his first name, but
Richard Alpert, Ram Dass.
All these great proponents of psychedelics were great teachers with great ideas, and so, like, you could look at the basis of what they said, boil it down, cut away all the bullshit, and they got some great ideas, and there's some real truth to the use of these substances.
Well, it's just, I don't think anybody should be doing it, though.
Like, you don't think anybody should be doing it?
No, not anybody. I mean, like, I don't think everybody should be advocated.
No, I agree with that. Like, I think that...
I think it should be taught. I think that it should be part of society. I think that psychedelics should be used in society, and if it was integrated into society as this sort of thing, like, where when you're growing up you are taught the methods and how to set up intentions and what something's for, but 16-year-olds going and buying something to party at their houses like we used to do, I think that's incredibly
dangerous. I never did that. I was never a part of that.
I thought that was incredibly dangerous, you know. And I've
I've never done drugs. For those of you listening right now, for those of you police officers listening to this podcast right now, I've never done drugs. I may lie about it from time to time to sound cool, but I've never ingested. I never inhaled.
Of course. But I don't know. I don't think children should be doing it. You know, I think I wasted a lot of time doing psychedelics, and that if I had had more of a head on my shoulders, that I would have gotten much more out of it. Like, as an adult, maybe it's just being older, you know, but using it as a tool, like, I don't know. They can be such a valuable thing. But like we were saying earlier, I don't think it's, you can get that, you can get to that space with meditation.
Mm-hmm.
You can get to that space with learning and talking and teaching and just being around certain people.
So that's why I think there's truth in the use of this, in the substance. Now, I agree with you. I don't think everybody should do everything. Just like there's not one set diet that works for everybody. Mm-hmm. Everybody's metabolism is a little different. Everybody's got different dietary needs.
Keto.
And so, like, you could consider, keto doesn't work for everybody. There's some people that need to be on the opposite of keto, need to have a carb-filled diet. And that's more rare, but that's beside the point.
Well,
so
your brain needs it.
So, with psychedelics, I think psychedelics should be a part of your mental health diet. Not everybody needs to have everything, but that doesn't mean that it should be, you know, outlawed and nobody can ever have it ever. So, like, you know, I think it also depends on the person. Like, you might have somebody who for whatever weird reason, they tried DMT when they were 12 and they were fine, but then maybe you got somebody who waited until they were 25 to try weed and then they lose their mind off of one puff. So everybody's different. And so I agree with you that it should be regulated and taught, and like there should be responsible drug use. And it should be part of your mental health as an adult. Mm-hmm. Like, it should be legal for a fucking 21-year-old to go down to, like, a pharmacy. And maybe you need a prescription for it. But, I mean, you talk to your doctor.
Or just
like,
flash an ID.
Yeah. I mean, it could be that. But it depends on the substance. Like, I don't think everybody should be able to flash their ID and get mescaline just because they have cash and a driver's license. Like, that's a little bit, you know. But you go to your doctor and you're like, doctor, I'm having trouble connecting with my ancestors. And he's like, all right, prescription for peyote. like if that was just a part of our culture, if it was more normalized, then it would be a lot easier for people to just get access to these things that they might actually need.
Peyote?
I can't hear the
TE. Yep, I'm working, buddy.
Here, I'll keep talking. So we just had a little guest. Gingerbread's son just came in and asked him for some assistance, and he went off to help him. He's a good dad. But anyway, so while I got you here alone. Oh, he's back. Okay.
Success.
So, I feel like It's really frustrating that, you know, this has been said by so many people for so many years, and yet for some weird fucking reason, there's still a goddamn war on drugs, and like how many thousands of people have said the exact same fucking thing that we just said about how, like, it should be okay for people to do this stuff if they want to.
But then one person hurts themselves. Just and then then all of a sudden you have an argument for, what about the children? What if we all jump out of windows and think we're a glass of orange
juice? It's the same thing with fucking paint. They still sell paint at Home Depot, but idiots drink it.
It begs the question for solidarity and how much trust you have in your people to make decisions. And if somebody does hurt themselves, how much responsibility is it on that person? And how little responsibility is on the state to uphold because somebody hurt themselves? Like, if somebody hurts themselves, okay, you fucked up. But does that mean that you automatically can judge my life because somebody else fucked up? Like, how much trust do you have in your people if one person automatically becomes a generalization for millions? You know, like, that doesn't make any sense to me. But you can see where their logic's coming from. But it's like an authoritarian parent. And I don't know how much of a role the government should be playing like that.
I agree with you. And the other thing that annoys me and frustrates me about this, and I mean, I love America. I'm going to talk some shit on our government, but I do love living in this country. So don't come after me, Proud Boys, okay? I didn't vote for Trump, but I didn't not vote for him. I didn't vote at all. But, but no, seriously, I love America, but something that pisses me off about our government is that the hypocrisy inherent in the system is like, you're talking about how they can make a drug illegal because of that argument right there. Mm-hmm. But you got a fucking drug like alcohol that's perfectly legal, billions. Kills thousands of people every fucking year just from alcohol poisoning.
You're so like, right.
And then you have to look at the thousands of people that die from, like, alcohol-related fatalities on the road.
Cars.
And, like, you know what happens when you fuck up on alcohol?
What about violence?
Violence, too. People and beating their wives and their kids and their dog, or, like, they have a bad day at work, they drink some Jack Daniels, and they take it out on Fluffy, the cat. Or they're beating their plants. Do you have any idea why Ivy clings to the wall? Because it's scared, goddammit. That's a George Carlin bit. I'm sorry, I stole that. But anyway, so it's really, really frustrating how, like, there's such hypocrisy there, where it's like, yo, we're gonna make this really, really, really beneficial drug illegal because, like, one out of a million people jump out of a window. But yet this other poisonous liquid is perfectly legal for everybody because the mafia loves it and we get a nice tax break off of it. But people kill each other all the people kill themselves, each other, and fucking...
I think it's almost like they had to give something. I think alcohol is just like...
You don't think it had anything to do with the mafia? Have you ever studied the Prohibition years?
Of course, and you can look back at the black market and heroin and cocaine nowadays. It's a very similar situation. But I think the reason that alcohol is legal and things like tobacco are legal, maybe one, because it's so indoctrinated in society, because every society has an obsession with alcohol.
You know? That's true. Since it was discovered. Yeah.
But second, it's almost like a one-off, like they had to give somebody something. Like, when, if we lived in a completely prohibited economy where nobody was able to expand their consciousness, you know, when somebody doesn't have an option to do something, it's almost like it's like, here, you know, you can keep alcohol, but you can't have all these things, you know, but this is like opium of the masses. Like, please just stay calm. You know, here's your booze.
I think that's also part of the reason why we have a prescription drug problem in this country. They literally are sedating us. They want to keep us numb. And I know this makes me sound like a conspiracy theory, and there's plenty of arguments against this, but it's very strange that the drugs that are illegal are the ones that make you think, and the ones that are illegal are the ones that dumb you down.
Yep. And I was hearing a lot of things, like all the people, like all the kids shooting shit up, like over the past couple of years. Like, I don't quote, fentanyl. Don't quote me. Fucking antidepressants.
Yes. Yeah, they're shooting
up. SSRIs. Mm-hmm. Most of the kids that were shooting people up were on SSRIs or some sort of antidepressant. Like, fucking...
It messes with your brain chemistry.
Yeah. Well, so does mushrooms, but... I feel like I'm a much more compassionate person afterwards.
Well, they've done a lot of different brain scans and, like, biochemistry studies, neurochemistry studies, where they, like, measure a person's, like, chemical levels when they're on mushrooms, and it shows that, like John Hopkins Society, they're the ones fucking leading the mushroom studies. So the John Hopkins Society is telling us that the way mushrooms affect your brain is positive.
Well, it actually lowers activity is what I heard. So it lowers activity in the prefrontal cortex.
No, I'm saying like after the experience.
Oh, yeah.
Like, they measure levels and they look at your brain activity and they say that the way the way psilocybin affects the brain is like a long-term change in your brainwave function. Mm-hmm. It actually changes the way you think on a measurable level.
It does.
And that is so important because, like, alcohol does the same thing, but in a bad way.
Well, it kills brain cells.
Yes, which definitely, I think that changes the way you think. So, how much alcohol you gotta drink before you can't remember your fifth birthday? Like, fucking, I think, like, that's a real question. I fear that every time I take a drink, I'm like, what brain cells are dying here? Like, what if it's my math?
I just don't trust it. I don't. But so what I've heard about psilocybin is that for a long time, there was a lot of theorizing that while you're on it, they thought that psilocybin increased brain activity.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels like you're lit up on it, you know. But what's really interesting is that the effect that they've been able to measure is that it actually lowers brain activity,
mm-hmm.
but it does so in a specific region. So it doesn't lower the entire brain, whereas alcohol depresses the entire nervous system.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas psilocybin, it pinpoints the director, the prefrontal cortex, mm-hmm. and it lowers the ability of the director to organize. So when you're on the psilocybin, your brain is able to freely connect. And so you get random brain bursts from neurons that have never communicated to each other before.
Mm-hmm.
And so instead of having localized modes, like usually if you get poked in the knee, you have a portion of your brain that's meant for knee. Whereas when you're on psilocybin, your brain's not moded for knee anymore. Knee could be here, 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 or here. And so you get these strange things. And then my assumption is that when you sober up, you have all these new connections.
Mm-hmm.
You have all these connections you've never had before.
I think that's true.
And you have access to them.
I've had a similar feeling. So, like, before the podcast, we were talking about DMT experiences, and you were telling me that you had that one time where you could see yourself talking to yourself, but, like, from a third-person point of view. Mm-hmm. And so I've had a similar experience on psilocybin where, like, at a high enough dose, I can literally feel or even, like, hear in my mind these thoughts. That honestly, it feels like the left side and the right side are like going back and forth. And I'm watching them. Yeah.
I think there's a couple in there.
For you, maybe. For me, there's two specific ones. And it's like because I think I have borderline personality disorder. One of my therapists told me that years ago that there might be a split between my left and my right. It's a condition with some people who've been like traumatized and molested when they were kids. But anyway, so on psilocybin, I feel like that wall comes down and I can actually feel the two halves talking to each other. And sometimes I can actually just sit back and watch the two have a conversation.
Yeah.
And it's very, very interesting.
So it'll happen when I'm dreaming too. So I don't dream much.
Mm-hmm.
I don't dream much. But sometimes, more often than not, multiple times throughout the week, I'll wake up at like 2 o'clock in the morning and it's like I'm tapped into that. And like, as I'm coming to consciousness, it's like I have two voices, and like, it's like I'm having full blown conversations, and it's like I'm listening to it, but I'm completely sober, just waking up. And it's like I can hear them in my room. Like, I'm not mad, I promise. Like, but it's cool though, because like I'm convinced that even when I'm not running the ship, that there's pieces of me that are doing things constructively and positively. And like, as long as I make sure the ship's clean and I do a good job of making sure everybody's happy and taken care of and respected, you know, like I have like, I'm going to have a really good ride. Yeah, you
know? So like, there's this really interesting question in psychology and neuroscience and honestly in a lot of like anatomy, just the study of the human body in general, like, or you know, even biology, the study of all of life. They got to ask the question of where is the life? Mm-hmm. It's like
it's in the action.
No, I'm saying like on a, like there, like this idea of the observer or the soul or whatever the fuck.
One of
like,
my questions was, what is the self?
Yeah, so we can do that. Exactly. So the, like that's kind of what I call it, nameless, because I think there's not a word for it and we cannot locate it. We can't define it. And it's something that is beyond our perception, because as human beings with this physical body and this modality of existence, it is very limited. There's colors we can't see. There's sounds we can't hear.
And then the things that you do see and the things that you do hear
are limited to your perception of them. How
much can you trust what you're perceiving in the first place? Because you always see things through the film of that equipment.
Yeah, and like crazy people see shit we don't see.
You only hear what your ear hears. You don't see the actual sounds that you're hearing. Mm-hmm. You always get that. You always get what your equipment's feeding you.
Yeah, so I always question my sensory input, because like me, I don't know if I've done too many psychedelics or if I'm just crazy or what the fuck, but I swear to God, there are times when I have to question my own sanity, because I'm like, what am I seeing? What am I hearing? What am I thinking? And sometimes maybe I'm encountering something beyond my perception. Like, it could be something supernatural, but there are other times when like I could be just having like a fucking, like a little mental breakdown, and maybe I like was hallucinating some shit, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, you see, like, a shadow out of the corner of your eye, or you hear someone say something, and then you're like, hello, hello, and then you're home alone. Like, auditory visual hallucinations. Most people have to pay for such a thing. Sometimes you have them when you're sober.
Well, you do when you're meditating. Sometimes I'll get fleeters when I'm meditating.
And, like, a lot of people like to say, like, oh, it was a ghost, but more often than not, I like to think that it's just my mind playing tricks on me.
I agree.
I think I have a touch of madness. I don't think I'm full-blown crazy, but I think that, like, I think everybody's a little crazy. I think everybody's got a touch of something.
I think the more you give yourself freedom to make up your own mind, and the more freedom you give yourself to create your own ideology, the looser those walls get, and the less structure you think you have, the more different you might perceive yourself. I wouldn't call that crazy though. Like, I've been playing with this idea that the more aware you are, because I hate the word enlightened, but the more awake you are, that I think that
the
Wookiees out there,
the Wookiees, like, the more Wookiee you are. I'm gonna fucking use that.
but the more awake you get, and the more aware you get of yourself and your feelings, the harder it gets to handle some of them. Because when you're more aware of what's going on inside you, you start to feel the lows more. And when you make mistakes, if you're more aware of what you do and you're more aware of your decisions, that it's harder to deal with your own mistakes than if you're being ignorant and if you're not aware. So the people who aren't consciously paying attention to themselves, they might make a mistake, they might hurt somebody, and it might not affect them as much as somebody who's actually aware of themselves and who's actually paying attention to themselves. That might be more painful for them. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense.
And I wouldn't call that crazy. I don't think that's crazy. I think that's just, you know, it's just the walls coming down.
That's a really healthy way of looking at it. That's probably a better way than what I was thinking. But it's still, fuck, I forgot what I was going to say. So the, going back to that question of what is the self,
yep.
Right? So like,
and nameless.
Science doesn't know where consciousness truly exists. So, my brain just farted so bad. Can you refresh my memory what we're talking about?
We're talking about the self.
We were talking about like how like your perception is limited to your anatomy
and to your equipment.
Yeah, and to your equipment,
your sensory, the what you see, what you perceive.
So how can you trust? I have this tattoo on my arm that says it perfectly.
What is real?
What is real? What is that? Just the word real, just the concept of it. What is that?
Completely subjective.
Exactly. It's something that we made up. Like, sometimes I think that this is a dream, and this is just the part of the dream where we become solid. Because I dream a lot, and a lot of them are lucid, and a lot of them are really vivid. Like, some of them are, like, non-lucid, but they're so vivid that I'm convinced it actually happened.
I want it badly. I badly want to be able to dream. All I get is voices.
You can get it. You can get it if you focus on it.
I try. And one of the things I've heard is to go throughout your day, and every time you go through a door, you're supposed to be, like, to question yourself, am I dreaming?
Yes. And yeah. The more you question reality.
A billion times a day. Mm-hmm. A billion times a day, I catch my consciousness. I'm like, am I dreaming or not?
Another thing that helps is edibles. Like, what I do is I pop about 20 milligrams right before I put my head on the pillow.
So I typically
it kicks in while I'm sleeping.
I eat about 200 every night.
Do less.
Probably.
Yeah, you might not be dreaming because you're smoking too much pot. I'm
completely stoned.
Yeah. Sometimes when I smoke too much weed, I just black nothing.
I've heard a lot of people say that when they stop smoking marijuana, that like within like 3 days, they start to get dreams back.
Well, I still get dreams when I'm smoking. I just like try to not smoke so much that it makes my dreams go away. Mm-hmm. So like you could still smoke, just cut back a little bit, especially with the edibles. Like if you're taking 200 milligrams every fucking night, that's like Joey Diaz numbers, dude. You're not even gonna feel them. Like my god, dude, like 200 milligrams would probably mess me up a little bit.
I enjoy it.
I like it too. I love edibles, but I'll do 200 milligrams in the daytime and have an adventure.
So you were comparing sensory data to the dream experience, which is an often comparison that's been used a lot. Have you ever mm-hmm. heard of René Descartes?
No, who's that?
René Descartes was a mathematician. He made up, if you've ever used a graph, a Cartesian graph.
You know what it is? I've heard of it, but
any graph. If it's a graph, that's a Cartesian graph. Okay. If it's a grid system, that's Cartesian. And so that was made by Descartes. Mm-hmm. He was a philosopher in the 1600s. Of course, he was an intellectual. What he did, though, is he put himself through this rigorous training where he decided he was going to put every thought he had through doubt. So he locked himself alone in a tower for several years. And he basically sat by himself as a hermit, and he went through every single idea and every thought that he could think of, and he put it through doubt. And one of the films that he did was, he was a religious man, so he's like, it's possible that at any time that there's a demon or a devil that is feeding me thoughts through my senses, because my senses have fooled me before. And there's been times that I've been dreaming that I've been convinced that I've been awake. And so I can never be convinced that I'm truly awake. So if there's an evil demon feeding me all of my thoughts, then how can I trust this thought? And after years, he gets to the bottom of his thoughts, supposedly. And he decides that the only thing that he can't doubt, the only thing that is undoubtworthy in his entire mind, is this one sentence. I think, therefore I am.
I've heard that before. So I did not know it was Descartes. I thought it was someone else.
So he decides that the only thing that's real in reality is that there is an observer. That there is an essence that is thinking, that there is at least something observing the thoughts, and that thinking self is him. And that's the only thing he can't doubt. Like, and so, but I loved it. The only thing he fucked up on is at the end, he decides that that he's one of God's thoughts, and that everything is God's thought, which comes back, wraps around again.
That goes back to Hinduism.
Yep, it does.
Yeah. Like, in one of the Vedas, or one of their sacred books, they say that all of existence is the dream of Vishnu, mm-hmm. which contradicts the other thing, that it's the dream of Brahma, and that there's another thing that says that it's not a dream at all, that it's something else. I don't know. There's a lot of contradictions in these old religions. But
everything, I've had this thing that I put on my Facebook. I can't remember it because it's Spanish. Urgle durgle. My apologies. Dead air, dead air, dead air. Oh, come on. Oh, you rat bastard. I just want to read words. Un camino entre cantidades de caminos, which was Don Juan. From Carlos Castaneda's The Teachings of Don Juan. And that means anything is one of a million things. That one thing can always breed a million different ways of thinking about something. Like, which I think it all wraps. It all comes back together mm-hmm. in a way. Like, I do.
Yeah. I agree with that. Definitely. I mean, that's probably like the most heady thing that we've said throughout this entire podcast. It's all connected, man.
We're all working with the same equipment. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's even if
some of us are working with bigger equipment than other. I don't know about you.
but I think it's even if it's not a supernatural element that we're all describing, maybe we all have similar brains and similar ways of looking at things, so we all come to similar conclusions. Mm-hmm.
That's true. So I wanted to. This is a really complicated concept, and it's not my idea. This is coined by a few different people, but one of the leading proponents of this theory is Graham Hancock, and
he's great.
You've studied Hancock's work. Sure. Yeah, so Hancock is a believer in this idea that our current run of civilization that started with Sumeria and has now led to us is not the first one. Mm-hmm. There were other civilizations before us that have come and gone, and that the knowledge that we are accessing right now, it's not just that we all have the same mind and we all think the same thoughts. It was like we've done it before. And what we're doing is actually rediscovering something that our ancestors already knew about. And it's quite possible that we're rediscovering it with the assistance of leftover bits and pieces of what was left behind. Hmm. And there's even stories of this. Like, one of the most interesting things that I've read from Hancock's work... Here, you can hit that again. Sorry, I've been kind of just holding it. Bogart and the weed. But so the fucking... the book I'm reading right now is called Fingerprints of the Gods. And
that's exactly who I was thinking of. I know who this Graham Hancock is.
So the chapter I just got finished reading was talking about how the fucking... God damn, my brain just farted again. How there is thousands of different versions of a story in South America about a man who traveled with a group of other men who looked very similar to him. It was a nine foot tall white man with a beard who looks very similar to the white Jesus that we know and love in America. And he traveled with a group of followers who also had like beards and they had white robes and they wore sandals, and they taught how to build, how to farm. They healed the sick. Some cases, they raised the dead. In some stories, they made buildings and they helped them build their pyramids, like the Mayan and Aztec temples that look like pyramids. And they're responsible for a lot of different stuff. In fact, there are whole tribes that believe that their whole culture and everything they know about science and technology came directly from Viracocha and his followers. Here's the kicker, though. The story is 17,000 mm-hmm. years old.
Well, that's how far back Egypt goes.
17,000?
Mm-hmm. Well, so
the Egyptologists tell you it's only 2,000 BC.
So, there's this guy named Mark Anthony West.
And Robert Schock. They were the guys who said the Sphinx is actually 15,000 years old, right?
The way they did that is they found water. They
erosion found on the Sphinx, yeah.
And there hasn't been enough rain in there mm-hmm. going back to 20,000 BC.
So it's interesting you bring up Egypt, because I just read this yesterday. I was reading in the book how Hancock, when he was down in South America studying the Mayan temples, there are these very, very, very strange parallels between the Mayan Book of the Dead, because they have one too, apparently. Most people don't know about that.
And the Tibetan one.
No, and the Egypt. There's parallels between the Mayan Book of the Dead and the Egyptian Book of the Dead. They even have similar kinds of sarcophagi and methods of mummifying their dead, especially their kings, and then the pyramid thing, the alignment with the stars. So Hancock postulates that the most likely reason why these two distant cultures have these same parallels is because they're both descendant of the same older civilization. Yes.
That makes sense to me. I'm 100% behind that. I think there's been other civilizations before mm-hmm. ours, and I think we've just forgotten.
Yeah, it's been destroyed, lost its time.
As soon as you lose knowledge, you don't know that anything exists. Mm-hmm. Like, what? Another cool thing, all those fucking pyramids, you know, there's pyramids in Australia too. The Aborigines go back that far as well, and some of their structures are literally 10,000, 15,000 years old.
Some of the Aborigine stuff goes back 50,000 years.
And then in Africa, in Mali, I can't remember the tribe anymore, but there's a tribe in there that dates back 10,000, 15,000 years ago, and they have paintings on their walls or whatever, and art structures that depicts Sirius and its twin star. And they had this creation myth where they drew the system of Sirius, and it's, and they had the everything.
And they believe that they come from that star system.
Yeah, I've heard of that before. Have absolutely no way to be able to see it. You can't see it with the naked eye. It's insane. Like,
and they also know what galaxy Sirius is in too. Like, isn't it in Andromeda? Like, it's not even in the Milky Way.
Like, they had absolutely no access to this, and we're talking about tens of thousands of years ago. And then what that screams to me is global culture. Mm-hmm. To me, that screams that we had a global species at that point, mm-hmm. and that our technology was far higher than we could even conceive. And I was just reading this one thing. So they found a box on the bottom of the Mediterranean Ocean going back to 500 BC, and it's an analog computer. So it's not like our computer. It's all gears, but it's a collection of over 30 gears that is used to tell star positions and to tell it like predicts weather. And it has dials on it. And they had to like x-ray it to even see inside of it, cause they couldn't tell what it was, cause it was on the bottom of the ocean. But it's literally an analog computer, like, nothing super, super crazy, but still way more technology than you would even consider at that point.
I think
500 BC is a low point. I think that whatever existed was probably like, I think 10 to 7,000 years ago was like the end of that, whatever that was. And I'm theorizing here. I have absolutely nothing to back up my shit.
Well, so Hancock has written many, many books on the subject. One of his books,
I've heard of Fingerprints of the Gods. I have it in my collection of things I want.
Yeah, definitely get that one. It's a good one. So the sequel to Fingerprints of the Gods, he co-authored it with a man named Randall Carlson, and it's called Magicians of the Gods. Now, if I'm wrong about that, and the one he co-authored with Randall Carlson, it has a different title, then I apologize for the fuck up. But anyway,
just Google it. Google will find it.
So you listeners out there, just Google Graham Hancock, Randall Carlson. They co-authored a book together, and the book describes their theory and the evidence, the overwhelming archaeological evidence supporting this theory, that they think they have discovered evidence that a comet hit North America when it was still covered in ice at the end of the last ice age, which is 10,500 BC, which lines up exactly with the date that Archimedes or Socrates, one of them, described the exact date when Atlantis sank. Mm-hmm. They have it written in one of their books. And
I think that's in the Republic. Mm-hmm. I think you're right. That's Socrates.
So that date lines up exactly. So they have all this archaeological evidence because they went all around America and Canada to find evidence of this comet impact that would have like vaporized and like insta-melted the glacier, mm-hmm. causing like millions of gallons of water to,
which would raise the level.
Yeah, raise the sea level, and it would also
Noah. What the Noah shit with
the, yeah, yes, with the flood myth. Flood. There's also the myth of Gilgamesh, and there's like a flood myth in almost every other culture on the planet. Yeah, right. So you're the flood right. actually happened, but it's a lot older than what we're told.
Yeah.
So the flood was because of this comet. Now, they think it was a comet, and there's some evidence to suggest it was a comet, but all they really have...
What about a volcano? It
could have been a volcano. All they really have is evidence of a natural disaster.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, me personally, I think it's entirely possible it could have been us. Like nuclear. Nukes.
Like, if we had the technology to fuck ourselves up.
Mm-hmm. Yep, could have been a self-destruct. It could have been an accident.
And if we're in the middle of an ice age, you got to think about diminished resources. What if it's at the tail end of a civilization? What if a civilization's been doing really well for a long time? Then the ice age comes, reduces resources, causes this inability to support everybody, and then you have more infighting, more disillusion.
And it's like, do we let everybody starve to death, or do we do population control?
Or just bomb each other, yeah. You got a point. It could happen.
I mean, they're, like, people talk about population control now.
Yeah.
And we probably have less people on the planet than they did back then.
Because
if it was a global civilization, it would have been able to support a population even larger than what we have now. And, like, we only have 7.5 billion people, but even that is considered to be too many by our leaders. And they talk about population control and about thinning the herd. It's kind of creepy.
It wouldn't be too much if we didn't use as much gas. If we had 7.5 billion people and we were living differently, it wouldn't be overpopulated.
Yeah, it's the
way we live that makes it overpopulated. It's the fact that I myself throw away a whole bag of trash every day, and I fill up an entire dumpster with trash in 1 week, and I'm just one person, you know, and I try.
That is a lot.
And I try.
I do one bag a week, dude. I'm just kidding. I'm not trying to shame you, but I really do one bag a week. Yeah. I recycle a lot of shit.
Yeah. Well, I have recycling too, but like, it's just like, I don't think we'd be overpopulated if we lived differently. And you know, at the same time, I don't know if I'm strong enough to live differently at this point. Of course I'm strong enough. I can make changes. Like, but you know, I'm already adapted to my life. You know, I'm used to my lights. It would be hard for me to go live in the woods, you know, or be like, I think I could adapt, but it would definitely be a difficult movement away from the comforts that I'm used to. And I don't live as comfortable as most people. I mean,
there's a lot of shit that we could keep and still have a really nice, comfortable life, but also make some changes to help the planet. Like, I think there's some people, like the Greta Thunberg types, talking about, like, everybody needs to turn their lights off and go back to candles.
You're killing our future.
No, I think that, like, it's a little too dramatic when you realize how big the planet actually is. Yeah. Somebody told me once, one of my teachers in school said that you could fit the entire population of the planet inside the Grand Canyon, and everybody would have like a 200 square foot apartment. And they're like, that's a lot of fucking space,
it's
man.
It's only because we're so needy. It's because our lives have been designed this way. And then even on the group scale, like how we develop our food is not smart. Everything is not smart.
I hate to say it, y'all, and I'm talking to the listeners right now, but you gotta cut the burgers. I'm sorry, man. I'm coming for your burgers. I'm coming for them.
Oh, yeah.
Gotta cut out the red meat, dude. And I'm not saying that I don't like red meat. I love a cheeseburger.
It just costs
too
much.
It's
too
much for the planet. It's way too much, yeah.
60% of the land in the United States is used for animal feed.
Yeah.
And so if we took that space and we created human food, can you imagine how much less starvation there would be? And how much easier it is to keep vegetables, how much more longevity they have. Like, you don't need as much refrigeration. You don't need, like...
And here's the other kicker. Like, you could keep a similar type of lifestyle, but just switch the specifics of it. Like, change the animal feed from corn to hemp.
Yeah.
Takes up less space, grows faster, uses up fewer resources in the soil.
Cotton.
Switch the livestock from motherfucking cattle and poultry to a different type of animal, like goat.
Yep.
That's what the Hebrews said.
So cotton is one of the biggest things, and we are all wearing it, you know, but what they're doing right now is there's a scientist in Bangladesh who's reverse engineered a cotton plant to make it so that its seeds aren't poisonous, because its seeds have this poison in it. So the seeds themselves are 30% protein, and the plant produces 5 times as much seed as it does cotton fiber. So if they can make this plant produce edible seed, you're already making it.
Yeah, you can start making bread, grain, all kinds of stuff.
It feeds the animals.
Yeah, it feeds the animals too.
There's a lot of fear when you look at the place that we've put ourselves in as a species, and I feel it. But at the same time, I don't think we give ourselves enough credit for all the options we don't know we have.
Oh, yeah.
Like
a lot of people, I was just listening to this earlier today. It was Tommy Chong talking to Joe Rogan, and he was talking about how he is not afraid of AI. Because if you look at AI from a logical...
That must have been a great show.
It was really fun. It was very fun. But, speaking of Tommy Chong here. But, like, so the, by the way, you can turn that up if it's not hitting hard enough. But anyway, he was talking about how he's not afraid of AI because he thinks that a true AI would be intelligent enough to understand the importance of kindness, respect, gratitude.
If we do it right.
If you have something that is truly self-learning and that is smarter than us, and like it would study our culture and it would be intelligent enough to be a true intellectual, and it would understand the importance of kindness and altruism.
That's the goal.
And so like you could have an AI that could actually save the planet. I honestly think that's what we need to be focusing on to solve certain problems, like the trash in the ocean, the fucking trash in the sky, like all of the space debris that's blocking our view of the stars and preventing us from going to other planets. Like, that's part of the reason why we haven't been back to the moon. So much goddamn trash, they can only launch a rocket like once a month with perfect timing because they don't want to fucking die.
Or send out a whole bunch of debris on the people.
Yeah, it's like they fucking, like the debris in space, there's so much, like, just little particles, like just screws, little pieces of shrapnel, and it's all moving so fast. that, like, if you were to fucking fly a rocket straight up and a fucking piece of shrapnel the size of, like, your pinky nail.
Well, you saw that video last right week. There was a video that was completely viral where the United States Space Station, like, barely missed this piece of metal. You could see it just fling by. That's fucking scary, man.
Yeah, so we need to develop technology that can help us fix these motherfucking problems. That's the solution. And, of course, that everybody... I'm sure people fantasize about that all the time. And I'm sure there are people working on it. But I think...
You have to monetize it, too.
You got to fund it.
Profitable and make it so people want to do it.
Oh, yeah. But I'm the money. My whole point was basically just agreeing with what you said a minute ago about how we don't give ourselves enough credit. Like, we are in a crisis. We do need to make changes. But there is a light at the end of the tunnel. Mm-hmm. We can get through this. And, like, I think that... Like reality is stranger than fiction. That's what they say. So whatever ends up happening is going to end up being a lot weirder and probably almost impossible to understand. But we're probably going to get through this just fine. Like, there's probably going to be some company in Japan that comes out with something in the next year that, like, changes everything. Some kind of robot or some kind of device that, like, straight up just, like, eats the trash in the ocean.
Or a fungus or a bacteria.
Something like that. Yeah, something that we haven't thought of yet. It's like thinking outside the box. I love that. Like, fungi could be the solution to the trash in the ocean.
They already are. They've trained fungus. Really? They've trained fungus to eat plastic. They've even trained fungus to eat radioactive material. There's already... strains of fungus that are naturally inclemented to it because they have to be able to withstand solar radiation. Think of lichen. Lichen are usually on exposed rocky areas, and there's lichen in desert environments. That's pure radiation. So they've even been able to start training certain breeds of fungus to eat radiated material. Yeah. Like, being able to get rid of, like, radiation and shit like that. Like,
yeah, Fukushima's gonna get saved! And Chernobyl, but I don't like the Russians, so...
Mushrooms are insane. Anyways, we are almost at almost 2 hours.
Jesus Christ, are you serious? That didn't feel like 2 hours at all.
We're at least at an hour and a half. So let's start wrapping this up. I would like you to take some time and just put out some links and put out some names, email addresses, websites, anything you can think of about yourself. You know, you just got off on a tour doing all your music stuff.
That was a bad experience. There were good experiences. I had a lot of fun on that tour, but The entirety of the experience was not very pleasant.
Copacetic.
Yeah, it was not at all. And I don't like to talk about it. I don't want to talk about it on the air. I'll tell you.
Not a problem.
I'll tell you when we get off the air, because there's some stuff.
But he's going out and he's seeing people, and in a couple of years he's going to be a very large name. And so, like,
oh yeah, so I'll give you the highlights, the positive stuff. So you said so just the tour, you know, I was out on tour just recently. I did 8 shows with Scene Loke and the Alien Baby Tour in the Midwest, and that was really great. All the people loved me. I did not get one bad reaction from anybody in any of those crowds. Made some new friends, new fans. And so if anybody wants to find me on the internet, you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, SoundCloud, Bandcamp, Reverb Nation, Spotify, Nameless. iTunes. Yeah, it's all under Nameless, but you gotta spell it right. Because if you don't spell it right, then you're gonna find up like 100 other pages from other people who call themselves Nameless, but they all spell it normally the way you find it in the dictionary. So it's NameLesz. And I think on Instagram, I'm actually Nameless Devil. It's all one word, but it still has the S and the Z in there.
Did somebody already have your name? Is that why you had to add the devil, or were you just feeling funky that day?
Yeah, I was just feeling funky. I think I started my Instagram in October, and so I was gonna. I had all this like Halloween content going on. Yeah,
so you weren't like Nameless Dracula.
No, I don't like vampires, but I mean, I don't have a problem with them, but they're just not my favorite horror creature. But yeah, so I chose Nameless Devil because I was being cheeky. And so that's what I'm on Instagram and Snapchat too. If you want to add me on there, I don't ever do anything on Snapchat, but hey, I don't. You can add me on there if you want. I don't care. So fuck. I would like to rap for the people, but I don't know if I can with my aligners in. I'm gonna give it a shot.
Do it.
Okay, so this is a song called Astral Projection. It's coming out on Spotify here in a couple weeks. It's like do it a cappella for you. All right, so I'm not writing rhymes to wine and I'm not signing off my time. I'm trying to find the right design to redefine true prime. In my mind, I combine like kinds of lines to define my incline. That reminds me of sublime as I refine to find cloud nines. Then I read the signs, align my mind, then untwine my binds inside. Then climb that bright vine that shines down light from the divine. Concerned within the chimes from our inner mental shrine. Then decline the unkind windup of my line. Thoughts opine till there's a splinter of darkness that is squatting in my mind. I'm trying to evict it through a code within these lines. As I go through introspection, I begin to realize the realizer of the truths we choose to hide from our eyes. It's a way of avoiding fate with the denial we devise. Some say they live forever like eternity was a prize, but you don't know how bored you get in 100,000 lives. Reincarnation's not a reward. You don't want to revive. Your true goal in this life is an inner vibration rise. Ascend to higher dimensions and truly become wise. So detach from your body now. Lift and fly above the ground. Give it a struggle with the sound. These instructions tell you how to break free from the matrix. Slip through the void with patience to the astral realm oasis. Hiatus from metropolis, you must unplug that stasis. The cage around our populace that keeps us numb and faceless and traps us in our places. The system is so heinous, but that's the basis of the nameless.
Fuck yeah, dude.
Thank you.
I'm really proud of you, man. You come so fucking far.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. You're gonna keep going, dude. Fuck yeah, man.
I know you keep hearing me say it, but I'm gonna keep prophesying it. You're gonna keep going.
I really appreciate that. Oh, one last thing to tell the listeners. I am also on YouTube. Most of my content, I put it out on YouTube because that's where I have the most reaction, and like I have the most fun putting shit on YouTube. It's the most free thing. It's the easiest to upload to. But anyway, so I'm doing this thing right now on YouTube. It's a series where every week I put out a new song. It's like a remix series because remixes are really important to hip hop as a culture. They're part of hip hop history. In fact, the very first hip hop song was a remix of a disco song. So that's hip hop is remixes. That's where it comes from. Yeah,
MCs and shit.
Exactly. And that was back in 1974. That's how old hip hop is. So I'm doing a remix series. Every week I put out a new remix. I pick like a classic beat or a popular song or sometimes like an obscure one that I just like. I'll take the beat and I remix it. And I'm putting it out on Friday. Okay, a couple of days I was late and I had to put it out on Saturday. But I'm doing it every fucking week. And what I'm doing is like I pick the beat, I write it that week. And then I record it, mix it, master it, release it. So it's all like, it's all fresh shit. And it's all like very, very hard to do. So if you guys find the time, please check it out. If you want it, if you like hip hop, if you want to check it out. I mean, I don't expect everybody to listen to every single one, but I'm doing this. I'm putting out all this free content just for the sake of the art form of hip hop. And also because I think that, you know, the original versions of some of these songs, and I'm not trying to be mean, but I don't think those rappers did justice to some of those beats. So I'm like, you know what? I'm going to fucking do it dirty. That's what the beat deserves. So yeah, you find me on YouTube. It's Nameless on YouTube, just like all my other shit. And that's what I'm focusing on right now. So I mean, like, if you want to see some, like, some hardcore lyrical hip-hop, like really bringing hip-hop back to what it's supposed to be, check out this remix series. It's Nameless Music. Thank you for having me on, Gingerbread. Good shit.
Thank you for being here, man. I really appreciate it. Thank you for your time. I mean that.